Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lisa Hansard from Texas Fertility Center. Welcome to this Saturday's session of Beyond the Birds and the Bees. We have such a great show today. Really inspirational story, and we're going to focus on third-party reproduction. That's our topic. So we'll get into that a little bit more. You can get more information about all of the physicians and the services we offer at www.txfertility.com. We are live on the air, so feel free to call in at 512-390-1370. I have the pleasure of introducing a couple that I've been working with over the past several years, and they have a really, really inspirational and amazing story. Matt, Sarah, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
We have known each other since 2009. And if you don't mind just sharing with us how you ended up seeking the services of Texas Fertility Center.
Okay, I'll start. I am a two-time breast cancer survivor. I was originally diagnosed about 6.5 years ago.
At age?
25.
Wow.
And then, you know, went through the whole chemo and surgery and all of that stuff. And I was on an oral medication that I had to be on for about 5 years. And then last October, I was diagnosed with a recurrence of my cancer. Came back locally.
October 2009,
that's right. And had to go through all of the treatment and everything again. And at the time, my husband and I were planning on, you know, starting a family, and we were very, very close to start trying to do that. But when I got diagnosed again, you know, that was obviously off the table, and we thought that genetic children were completely off the table.
And why is that? Why did you think that?
Well, my cancer was or is estrogen positive, which basically means that it feeds off of the estrogen, the hormone that I make.
That would be elevated during a pregnancy.
Right.
Okay.
And then also, you know, I would, we were worried about the chemotherapy damaging my ovaries. And my doctor, my oncologist really wanted to kind of shut down my ovarian production. She didn't want that estrogen, you know, soaring around just normally. So, but when I, you know, had my consult with my oncologist, she really pushed that we should try to do fertility preservation through the IVF process, which was wonderful because we didn't think that that was an option for us. And so that's how we came to you and met you through that. So.
When you were originally diagnosed at 25, was there a conversation at that time about fertility and fertility preservation?
Nothing that the doctor initiated. I remember sitting in the doctor's office with my mom, and at the time, Matt and I were together, but we weren't engaged. We were just, you know, boyfriend and girlfriend.
Right.
And I was 25 and not really, you know, children weren't on my radar, but my mom asked about it. I remember her asking the doctor about it, and she said, you know, no, you should be fine, and we kind of left it at that. And I really didn't want to harvest eggs or anything like that at that time. I just kind of wanted to get finished with my treatment. I didn't want to.
Right. You wanted to get well, because I can't imagine at 25, single, with this cute guy that may or may not be in the picture long term, even having to.
Who is that?
Oh, yay. Hey, wait. You're still here. Having to think about those decisions when you're still reeling from a diagnosis like that as a 25-year-old.
Totally, yeah.
So we fast forward 5 years, and you're finishing your treatment, looking for that 5-year survival.
Right. And actually have opportunity. Passed the diagnosis date. Like, it had been 5 years since my diagnosis, and was just finishing up this treatment that I was on.
And how did the how was the recurrence diagnosed?
It was actually a recurrence on top of my reconstruction in my breast, and I found it.
You just found a mass, and
And I thought that there was something wrong with my implant, so I saw my plastic surgeon, and he ordered an MRI, you know, just to be sure that it was nothing. So,
and it wasn't nothing, unfortunately. But fortunately, diagnosis was made, so you could move forward and start talking about therapy.
That's right. Yeah.
So when we met, you know, the conversation was, this treatment's going to involve more therapy that could potentially affect your fertility.
Right, right.
Maybe more certainly affect your fertility
right.
in the future. And you came to talk about the options. So do you remember that initial consultation?
I do. And I remember when, you know, once, you know, IVF came to the table and was an option for us, we definitely wanted to go forward with it. But once those embryos were created, we didn't know what we were going to do with them. We were like, you know what, we're just going to do this so we can have an option to do something with them.
Perfect. And I think that's really, really important because, you know, you were then facing, all right, we were thinking 30, 31 years of age, ready to start having kids. I'm going to keep this guy around. Right, Matt?
Right. Yeah.
And, and you still have, and now you're being told, okay, you're going to have to wait at least another 5 years if you're even going to be able to be pregnant, because this goes back to the estrogen receptor right. positivity of the tumor and so on. So if you don't mind sharing with the audience a little bit about that process of going through the treatment to stimulate your ovaries and kind of the timeline for that.
Well, sure. Well, my oncologist said that we definitely had time to do that, and she thought it was really important that we do it. So once we saw you, we, you know, started the process with all the tests and everything. And I mean,
what was that, November?
Yeah, that was in November.
And then you started chemo in January.
January.
So it was basically a month.
Basically the month of December is when we did the stimulation and the retrieval and all of that.
Right. So we actually met on November 13th of 2009 and had the conversation about where you were in your cycle and how quickly we could get you to a point of being ready to start the stimulation right. process. And the stimulation actually started on December 7th. So we got through Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. got your cycle in sync, and then got busy.
Yeah.
And then from that point, it was less than 2 weeks before you'd done the stimulation, had the egg retrieval, mm-hmm. had the embryos fertilized.
Yeah. And then started chemo in January.
And then started chemotherapy in January. So this is where the story gets really, really interesting and fabulous.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So tell me about the circumstances surrounding the current pregnancy.
Matt, do you want to talk about this?
Sure. Yeah, Matt, you talk
it's
about
real, it. You know, it's really fuzzy in my head. Like, people ask us how we came to, you know, now, and I'm like, I don't really remember. It's kind of a blur.
Well, on the day of her second diagnosis, when we diagnosed the recurrence, I talked to my sister on the phone, and we talked a long time and just about the recurrence. And then she called me back about 10 or 15 minutes later and said, I just wanted to tell you that a few weeks ago I had this dream that I carried you and Sarah's baby, and it was just a really vivid dream, and I thought it was weird, but now it's just got me thinking about it. And she said, I just want to let you know that if you ever needed that — at that time we didn't know we needed it, this was the day of the diagnosis — if you ever needed that, then I'd do it. And so so then fast forward a couple of weeks after about a month after we met with you, and mm-hmm. I sort of called her back and said, remember that dream you had? And so my sister is our surrogate. And so that was how that came about.
And she lives in?
Georgia.
Georgia.
Yes.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about just the medical process, if you don't mind, to catch people up to date. Because it's like, wait a second, were the embryos in limbo? I mean, how did that happen? And so when you went through the stimulation process and the egg retrieval and the fertilization of the eggs, again, not knowing when or how a pregnancy was going to happen, we put the embryos in cryopreservation, froze the embryos for use at a later time. And so your sister came through screening process, and she has how many children?
She has 2 children.
Right, from previously. And her age?
She is 34.
Right. So this is another question that comes up, because we talk about gestational carriers. That term is used interchangeably with surrogate, but the reality is surrogacy by definition involves the egg coming from the woman who is also carrying the pregnancy. And so traditionally, surrogacy was accomplished with artificial insemination of a woman using her own egg, and then she carried a pregnancy for intended parents. These days, surrogacy is actually not legal in Texas, and so the term gestational carrier is utilized because that implies that that's really their role in the process. So to make sure it's clear to everyone in the audience, obviously it's clear to all of us, this is a child that's genetically Matt and Sarah's that is being carried by your sister. Okay. And so the process was really straightforward, other than she's long distance. And she underwent some screening evaluation, making sure that she was healthy enough to be pregnant, making sure that her uterus was normal in all ways. And then we did a very simple hormonal preparation of the uterus to have it ready for implantation of the embryos. She came to Austin and we thawed the embryos at the appropriate time in the hormonal preparation, transferred the embryos into her uterus, kind of like a pap smear process, really, really simple. She stayed a day or two and then went back home to wait and to continue the hormones. Tell me about the day that you got the news.
Which day? It was kind of an emotional time because, you know, Lisa, she couldn't wait. And she's like, I'm just going to, this is not recommended, but she went and got a home pregnancy test and took it. And it came back positive. And then she went back to her doctor and he did a blood test. And he's like, oh, yeah, you're pregnant. And so we were very excited and happy. And then Dr. Hansard's office called and said, well, we're cautiously optimistic about this because the numbers weren't doubling or weren't as high as they wanted. And so at that point, we were bummed, you know, that maybe we were all wrong and, you know, getting excited too soon. But as, you know, we were patient and waited and went through additional tests about 2 or 3 weeks after that.
3 weeks later, yeah.
I think she had an ultrasound.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we saw, you know, the sac and everything. And so at that point, we were excited again. So.
And she ended up being on the hormone supplementation through about the 12th week of pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And then the placenta took over and we got her off of all her hormones. Mm-hmm. And then she's just pregnant like the rest of the world.
That's right.
So you want to tell us what the status is of that pregnancy now?
She's about 33 weeks pregnant.
So due date is?
April 13th.
Yay.
And we're in the home stretch and Lisa just threw us a shower in Atlanta last weekend. So that was interesting. And
that was a shower
exciting.
For everybody, right? So it's Lisa's throwing the shower for her mm-hmm. niece.
Right. That's right.
Isn't that fun? That's awesome. In her uterus.
That's right.
Very, very, very cool.
Yeah.
And so what are your plans for the birth?
Well, we are going to go to Atlanta about 2 weeks before she's due and just, you know, hang out and wait and then we'll be there when Lisa delivers our daughter.
Hey.
And right now, I mean, if you want the details, our plan is to have Matt cut the cord, and then I'll get the baby after she's delivered. So I get to hold her first.
That is just absolutely wonderful. We cannot wait.
Yeah.
Meet her.
Yeah.
And you shared some ultrasound pictures with me just before the show, and mm-hmm. she's precious and has, you know, at least 5 toes on that 1 foot. And it's really, really an exciting time. How was it going through the process of treatment, knowing that you had this fabulous event to look forward to? Do you think it made it easier?
I mean, for me, it made it easier for sure because, you know, you look forward to the end of treatment just because it's the end of treatment. You know, that's an exciting, you know, momentous occasion on its own. But knowing that instead of having to be done with treatment and get on with your life and, you know, worry about your cancer, which is, you know,
never going to go away,
never goes away.
Right.
We we've got this really wonderful, positive thing on the horizon that we could really focus on. And I'm going to get all emotional, but we know that this baby is meant to be here. And,
absolutely.
You know, if it wasn't for cancer, she wouldn't be. So
that's a positive, positive way to look at it.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, we're going to cut to break. If you guys don't mind sticking around just a few more minutes, if we have any callers that have any questions for Matt or Sarah, they'll be here to answer the questions. And thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back with Beyond the Birds and the Bees. Welcome back to our show. This is Dr. Lisa Hansard from Texas Fertility Center, and I'm here with Sarah and Matt, and hopefully you were with us before the break and heard their amazing, joyful story, where we really have something so exciting and fabulous in the future, which really came from a pretty tragic and sad time. And so thanks so much for sharing your story. I want to talk a little bit more about just this process of working with a gestational carrier and who can be a gestational carrier and how that works and what some of the other situations are. We are live, and feel free to call in at 390-1370 if you have a comment about this or any other fertility related issue. So in your situation, Sarah, we looked at using a gestational carrier to achieve a pregnancy because you were in a situation where it was not healthy for you to be pregnant.
That's correct.
Okay. So I don't know if our audience is aware of what's kind of gone on in the media lately, but there was a recent publicity surrounding Nicole Kidman and her husband, Keith Urban, who have recently had a child with the help of a gestational carrier. And that's what really inspired me to want to talk about that a little bit more. This past week on Austin Today on Fox, I had the opportunity to talk about this very same topic with another one of my couples that I've worked with who have twin girls who are actually celebrating their birthday this weekend with the help of a gestational carrier. And in their situation, there was no obvious cause for not being able to carry a pregnancy. But every in vitro fertilization cycle resulted in a loss or lack of pregnancy, even though we had embryos that looked healthy and wonderful. And I had suggested that maybe that would be the answer. And she and her husband had, I believe she said, 5 people volunteer once they started sharing their story. So it's interesting how many people love you that are willing to help when they understand that there's a problem like this. The other situations where we've looked at gestational carriers are in women who have either been born without a uterus or born with a uterus that was deformed, or have had to have a hysterectomy at a young age for some kind of a medical problem. I have another couple I'm working with right now who have a gestational carrier who's pregnant, and the reason is because the wife has a very significant chronic medical condition where she was told she should never be pregnant. So a very similar story to yours and going through in vitro fertilization and having embryos that then have been transferred into someone else's uterus. Since you guys have shared the story, not with the world until, you know, today, I'm really interested to know what the response has been. What do people say to you when you say, yeah, we're pregnant and my sister-in-law, my sister is carrying the pregnancy? What's that been like?
Well, when I tell my survivor friends, they always, I swear, they always start tearing up and saying it's wonderful because, you know, they understand, you know, what cancer takes away from us. But when we tell people that don't necessarily know that story about us, for the most part, they're all very excited. And, you know, they say how wonderful it is because it is wonderful. But a few people,
a little confused.
They're a little confused.
Tell me what's confusing. So obviously it's just out of ignorance about the situation. Yeah. But what do they say?
Well, the fact that it's my sister, I think, is as one layer of confusion.
Oh, because it's like, ooh, is that like legal?
Is that okay?
Is that baby going to have like 14 heads? Yeah.
And they don't come out and say that, but you can see the look on their face, you know?
Yeah, the wheels are turning in their head. They're like, how does, really?
How exactly does that work? You also mentioned looking for childcare.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, we're looking at, you know, childcare right now. We're taking tours, and some people will sort of glance down and, you know.
Well, they always ask, when are we due?
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's
it. We say April, and then I always see them look at Sarah, and they're like,
wow. Sometimes. They're like, wow, you don't look pregnant. I was like, well, I'm glad that I don't look pregnant because I'm not.
Instead of just going, thank you, I'm really hiding it well.
And when we just say, you know, it was really funny because at first we really tried to give this long, convoluted explanation of what we were doing and where our baby was coming from. And finally we just are saying, we have a surrogate, and that people sort of understand what that means.
Right.
And if they have questions, of course, they ask them. But
and it's interesting, too, if we, like you said earlier, that, I mean, the correct term is gestational carrier.
Right.
But I feel like if I say gestational carrier to people, they're going to be even more confused. But when I say surrogate, people are like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, I've kind of gotten used to saying that to people just to cut down on the explanation.
And, I still think that the terms get used interchangeably the time, and that's okay. But in that particular situation, if you knew, and then you said, my sister's our surrogate, then the heads really start spinning. They're like, ooh, yeah.
We've been using a cooking analogy or a baking analogy. We say that, you know, Matt and I made the cake, but Lisa's just baking it for us.
I love it. That's perfect.
And Lisa's actually, she's kind of used that with her children too, so they kind of understand.
Actually, Lisa's probably got better stories about confusing people than we do.
Can you share any of them?
Yeah, she was at she was at Belk once. She was shopping at Belk with her daughters in kindergarten, and they were shopping, and they went up to the cash register, and the lady was like, "Oh, when are you due?" And Lisa said, "April," and Anna said, "That's Sarah and Matt's baby." So then they had to tell her the whole story, you know, because she looked completely confused. And she ended up giving my sister like an extra 30% off her purchase.
Yeah, she did.
And then Lisa's like, oh, I think maybe I'm going to use this use this story a little bit more frequently.
More
see
items.
What else I can get. Yeah. One of the things that we didn't talk about, and I know what the laws are in Texas, but how is this going to work out with the birth certificate? What did you have to go through from a legal perspective for this to happen?
We had to.
Go ahead.
We got in contact with a lawyer in Georgia who is taking us through all the paperwork. There was one set of paperwork in the summer.
It was a pre-transfer contract with Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're in the process. In Georgia, the law is that the person who delivers the baby is on the birth certificate as the biological mother, regardless of who's actually biological. And so we're now going through just the paperwork, and there's going to be a hearing that we don't actually have to go to. But there's a hearing put us as the original biological parents on the birth certificate. So
yeah, and that's all happening pre-delivery and everything. And we're really lucky because a friend of mine who is an attorney in Atlanta knew this attorney, and this is all she does is, you know, family law, adoption, surrogacy, gestational carriers. So she was like, yep, here you go. And
yeah,
so that part was it was really nice to have somebody who really knew, you know, what she's doing and has relationships with some of the judges and they understand.
I've actually interacted with her because I've had to provide a bunch of documentation and clearly she's on the ball and is getting everything in place. So it's not a process. Mm-hmm. Up until about 5 years ago in the state of Texas, this same exact situation, just like Georgia, the birth mother is the mother of record. And then there was basically an adoption process that had to take place. Even though the birth mother may have absolutely zero genetic connection to the child, and in this case doesn't, you still had to basically sue for custody, go through an adoption. Really ridiculous. And so one of the reproductive endocrinologists who lives in Dallas was pretty instrumental in spearheading an effort to get that changed in the state of Texas. And so there's a little quirk, which is kind of funny, in the law, but as long as the gestational carrier has previously had a full-term delivery, then the intended parents or the biological parents can be the parents of record on the birth certificate. If this is her first pregnancy, she can still be a gestational carrier. There's not a limitation to that. But that old process where she's the birth mother and this goes, you know, you go through the process of an adoption is still in place. Isn't that funny?
That's weird. Funny. That's weird.
I have no idea why. I have no idea why. But I will say, talk about this all the time because, you know, with third party reproduction, which means donor egg, donor sperm, gestational carrier, the legislation in Texas is very progressive and very, very favorable for the intended parents. So donation is donation, whether it's anonymous or known, and the law is absolutely clear that the intended parents have full parental rights and responsibilities, and the donor, whether it be egg, sperm, or gestational carrier, have no parental rights. So this is important because when we talk about surrogacy, you guys are young and don't remember all this, but way back in the day, there was this case called the Baby M case. Are you familiar with that at all?
No, not me.
And this was, I believe, in Chicago, if I'm not mistaken. And it was a true surrogacy situation where there was a woman who had a physical condition where she was precluded from becoming pregnant. And so they employed a surrogate, had a contract with her, and she was the egg donor as well. And artificially inseminated with the husband's sperm and became pregnant. And then as the pregnancy progressed, she decided that she did not want to relinquish the child to the intended parents. The problem with that situation is the law wasn't clear. They had a contract, but it was just a contract. And the child was biologically her child. But biologically, also the child of the intended parent husband, right? So this was in the court system for years and years and years. And it's really what prompted states like Texas to put these laws in play saying surrogacy is not okay. And really giving the rights back to the intended parents. So that's where that whole thing came from. That's the background. Baby M. So everything's legally going to be in place. You're going to show up for the delivery and you're going to bring your daughter home from the hospital, signed, sealed, and delivered back to Texas.
That's right.
To start her life with her biological parents. Wonderful. That's just such a great story. Well, we are going to cut to break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk to one of our nurses, Jennifer, who's going to talk a little bit about her role in screening egg donors. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you after the break.
Talk 13.
Fertility, they're expanding their families, and there is help out there. Dr. Lisa Hansard is with the Texas Fertility Center. We're going to put her on ice for about 1 minute while we get a story, and then we'll chat with you. But welcome. We're glad to have you.
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Lisa Hansard with Texas Fertility Center. And that little intro was from our Fox Morning Show last week when we were talking about this very same topic. I'm going to shift gears just a tiny bit here. And, you know, we were talking about less conventional means of building families. And Matt and Sarah have shared their story of being able to become parents through the help of a gestational carrier who happens to be Matt's sister. I kind of joke with patients or, you know, new folks that I see that I want to talk about fertility. And I say, there's not a situation. A situation does not exist where we can't get a baby in your family. And I challenge anybody to try to come up with that scenario where with the help of third party reproduction, we aren't able to make that happen. One of the most common treatments that probably gets a lot less press because you don't necessarily know about how someone conceives a pregnancy, but one of the most common things is having the use of an egg donor. And this is a situation where a couple are trying to conceive, and the problem is not with the woman's uterus, but the problem is with the quality or quantity of her eggs and not able to achieve a pregnancy because there's not a healthy egg that can make a fetus. So I've got my nurse in our oocyte donation program with us, Jen. Hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good. Glad to hear it. I'm going to ask you some questions about just the process for the donor. So how does a young woman become an egg donor? What does that look like?
Typically, they call in and they're interested in becoming an egg donor. We screen them and ask them if they're between the ages of 21 to 32. If they live here in the Austin area or the surrounding area, and we get them started on some pre-screening questions.
Okay, so these women find out about us through various. How do they even know about it? How do they find out about us?
The internet, basically. A lot of them will Google it. They have friends that have done it before, word of mouth. We've got Craigslist, The Chronicle, Facebook.
Right. So social networking sites, obviously, in that population of women is huge, right?
Well, it is.
We just recently looked at our kind of statistics and demographics for our donors and found that at least a third of them have come from former donors. So that means we're doing something right.
Yes.
They're telling their friends that this is a cool thing to do and we're not mean people and and so on and so forth. And so this we're really lucky and really unique in that we have a large pool of egg donors that really work specifically with Texas Fertility Center. How does it work for most centers? Do they have their own donors?
A lot of them, you know, they do have their own pulls. Otherwise, they do have to pull from agencies. And those agencies can be nationwide. So their egg donors are not in that area. They're having to travel into the area that the recipient lives in.
Okay. So they could be on the East Coast or the West Coast or who knows where. And they're coordinating these cycles long distance.
Right.
And then the donor has to travel for the actual procedure.
They come in for their initial exam to meet the physician, and then we coordinate, we monitor them out there in their city, and then they'll come back towards the end of the cycle when we're close to retrieval.
And then stay through that process and then go home.
Right.
Basically. Okay. So let's say that some young woman shows up and says, hey, I heard this is a good thing to do, and I really would love to help out a couple that needs this. Can you talk to me a little bit about what the screening process involves?
Yeah. First off, they start with the pre-screening questions, FDA questions, and, you know, BMI qualifications. Once they've passed those screening questions, then we move them on to the next step, which is the medical history, which is for themselves and their family. So generally, if they don't have an idea of what's going on in their family, we ask that they, you know, talk to someone that they're comfortable talking with, you know, in their family, so they can get that information not only for themselves and their medical history, but, you know, just for the general well-being. After we've screened their medical history, we bring them in for a consultation. We talk face-to-face, go over the whole donor process, you know, things that may occur in the process and what to expect. We also go over all of those steps, which after being chosen for a cycle, because these girls do provide photos from a, you know, birth to age 15. And since we're in the Austin area, we don't show any photos that would give away their identity of who they are. You know, you're not walking around the grocery store and you say, hey, that's my donor. Yeah,
that's what I always say. I go, we don't want you to be in Zeta Austin and look over and go, oh, look, our donor's having a margarita. it's a really extensive questionnaire. And when you talk about FDA questions, this is really, believe it or not, the Federal Drug Administration is who regulates donor tissues. And so they're really interested in preventing the transmission of communicable diseases. So there's the questionnaire, then the medical history to make sure that they don't carry anything significant in their family. With the BMI, right? Which looks to make sure that they're of an appropriate height-weight ratio. And then they actually are placed in our donor profile pool, which is all available online to our recipient, a secure site to our recipient couples. So our couples get a password that are looking for an egg donor, go into the site, and they can start looking at all these profiles on the donors in our pool.
Correct.
So once a donor's been selected, what does the screening from that point on look like?
Once they're selected, then we send them for a psychological evaluation.
What specifically is going on there?
We're looking at an MMPI, which is testing their ability, you know, basically, are they being truthfully honest, if they're not being manipulative, you know, just...
So it's looking for any kind of underlying...
issues.
Psychological issues that the donor may otherwise be able to hide in just a face-to-face interview.
Right.
Okay. So they pass their psych eval.
They pass their psych eval, and then they come into the office with their physician. They will have an exam while they're on their period, and we'll do an antrafollicular count. So we're counting their follicles that are at rest on the ovary.
To make sure that they're going to be a good responder.
Right.
Okay.
And we're doing a full body exam. And we're also going to do genetics.
Let's talk about the genetic testing. What's involved in that?
The genetics, we do two different types. We do saliva genetics, which tests over 100 different genetic diseases.
To see if she's a carrier of any of these single gene abnormalities.
Correct.
So that's like sickle cell and cystic fibrosis and muscular dystrophy and all of those different diseases, right? Okay.
And then we also will send them to the lab to get their karyotype drawn.
To make sure they're 46XX?
Yes.
They really are girls, like they say they are.
And...
also testing for Fragile X?
Yes.
Right.
That's the most important.
That's very, very important. So now she's passed all those. What else is involved in testing?
The infectious disease screening.
Okay. So this is FDA, again, regulated. And what all are we testing for with that?
We're testing for HIV 1 and 2, hepatitis B core and surface antigen, hep B core, excuse me, hep C. And syphilis, chlamydia, and gonorrhea.
All right, so full screen there. And then they also undergo a toxicology screen, right?
Yes, that's actually at the very beginning. Before they are become active on our site, we do a drug screen and cycle day 3 labs.
Okay, so we're making sure that we have normal ovarian function and that this is not someone who abuses any narcotics or other illegal substances, right?
Right.
Okay. So once a donor's been chosen and passed her screening,
then
what happens next?
We put the cycles together. We synchronize them. The recipient, her period with the donor's period. We're placing both of these girls on birth control pills so we can get the recipient basically a week ahead of the donor. So we can get that lining ready for when we need to transfer those embryos.
So the recipient woman, the one who for whatever reason can't use her own eggs to become pregnant, starts the process of preparing her uterus for implantation.
Correct.
Once we know that the donor's going to be ready, that her uterus is developing well, then the donor starts the stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
So that process is very similar to what Sarah had undergone,
right,
where every taking injections to stimulate the ovaries to grow follicles, every 3 days or so, having an ultrasound evaluation done, having a blood test done to monitor the dosage of medication and so on. And that's about a 2-week process?
Roughly.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the egg retrieval.
The egg retrieval is under IV sedation. The egg donor will arrive that day. An hour later, the husband will arrive to provide his specimen. We will keep the egg donor there at the IVF, St. David's Fertility Center, afterwards, just to monitor her and make sure everything's going okay. And then she'll leave.
Okay. How does the egg retrieval happen?
It's sonoguided. And see, all of our sonograms are done transvaginally. So with this one, it is a transvaginal sonogram. However, they're going to put a needle on the end of that with a needle probe and guide it through to aspirate those follicles.
Okay, so everything's done through the vagina. There's no incisions. There's no general anesthetic. Process takes about 20 minutes, and then she's done.
Right.
Done.
Totally done.
Great. So start to finish, from the time that she's selected, maybe a 6 or 7 week process, with the majority of the effort coming in the last 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that sounds like a lot of investment of time, effort, taking some risks. So tell me a little bit about what the donors get out of this. Is there a compensation?
There is a compensation of $5,000. And the donor does really need to have a flexible schedule.
Because when she's signing up for this, basically she can't say, oh, I'm available Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, but not Thursday through Sunday, because we just do what the ovary tells us to do, and the ovary doesn't realize when it's the weekend, right?
Right, and we don't know which recipient is going to pick her and who her physician is going to be, so.
Or what the schedule is going to be like. So it really does demand quite a bit of flexibility on the donor's part.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the things that makes this such a popular and successful option is that the pregnancy rates are ridiculously high.
Yes.
So if we know that average chance of a conception for couples, you know, conventionally trying to become pregnant is about 20% in any given month, the success rate for this runs somewhere between 75% and 80% for the cycle, right?
Sure does.
And then if the donor stimulated well and had lots of eggs and there was good fertilization, that recipient couple has those embryos for subsequent pregnancies and siblings down the road, right?
We laugh at when there's frozens.
We love it when we have embryos in the freezer. That's right, because it gives us lots and lots of opportunities. Well, what should someone do who's listening to the show who thinks that this sounds like something they'd want to learn more about?
You can contact us at the office. We do have a 1-800 number. It's 1-888-MY-DONOR. Or you can go onto our website at www.txfertility.com and go to the tab that says Becoming an Egg Donor.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Jen. I appreciate that. The other services that we are looking into now are also we're starting an embryo donation program where couples who have gone through IVF procedures and become pregnant and finish their family building, but have embryos that were frozen that aren't going to be transferred, they have the opportunity to donate those embryos. And I'm really excited about this because it's going to offer opportunities for couples where these other options may not be feasible for them financially or medically. So we're really, really looking forward to that. For more information on this process, on infertility treatment, evaluation in general, please feel free to visit the website at www.txfertility.com. This is Dr. Lisa Hansard with Texas Fertility Center, and I want to thank my guests, Matt and Sarah, and Jennifer for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your Saturday. Cheers.